so.
Right, it can be stressful if you get in a traffic jam or a car accident. You ready, Jessica?
Yeah.
Okay. Good morning. It is 9:10 in the morning, February 20th, 2017. Call to order the quarterly meeting for the City of Ocala Firefighters Retirement Plan. I'm going to go ahead and go with attendance. I'm just going to go around and let everybody name themselves. Randy Griffin.
Justin Hardy.
Dave West.
David Guy.
John Dozier.
James Williams.
Cindy Kelly.
Ellen P. Danger.
Jessica Collin.
Okay, and I'm assuming that Larry will be here shortly. All right, first thing on the agenda is public comments. I don't see anybody, so I don't think we have any public comments. Next to that is the evaluation report from NIHART. And David Harris couldn't make it this year, so David Guy is the one that does a lot of the work with David Harris. So he has come down from Atlanta, from NIHART, and he is here to present the report. So with that, the floor is yours, David.
Good morning, everyone. I believe we're going to test one more out. Good guess.
Yes, my name is David Guy, and I've been at NIHART since the beginning of my career for 6.5 years. And I am an actuary at NIHART and work on the Ocala plan extensively and have been for the last 6.5 years. So thank you for letting me come here to report on the evaluation. So let's get started on the management of the board summary here. Got a table of contents, no need to explain that. So the summary of results is comparing line by line the results from the prior year evaluation at October 1st, 2015 to this year's evaluation, October 2016. And as you can see, the increases, there's an increase in liabilities, but also an increase in assets. Funded ratio stayed just about the same. Payroll did increase by quite a bit. That's a thing we'll talk about later. And then the bottom of the page is just all the pieces that comprise of the contribution. And as you can see, the dollar amount increased, but as a percent of payroll, just increased by under 1%. Okay, moving on to the next page, page 3. This is just tracking the contributions that have been calculated as a percent of payroll. And so not a big change from last year to this year, but historically slightly lower than it has been in the last 5 years. Page 4 will show you the plan experience. So this is how we track what exactly changed and how it's impacting the plan's contribution and that contribution as a percent of payroll. And so the demographic experience you can see is 1.4 million. It's primarily due to the increase in payroll, which has a compounding effect on the pension plan because the benefits are calculated as a percent of payroll. And then the assumption changes was the about a half a million increase based on the state requirement to move to the Florida Retirement System's mortality assumption. And that's just a new law, so we moved to that.
I understand there's another one already.
Oh, really?
Is this going to be in place next year?
Is it impacting mortality, or do you know which they're targeting?
It's going to be less costly.
Okay.
So more of a friendly mortality, pension-friendly mortality rate.
I will say for this plan, that is a pretty easy pill to swallow. We've had some other plans where you're talking 10% payroll contribution increases. So it's...
Yeah, because we had already changed it, I think, the RP 2000.
Right. You eased yourself into this change. So
yeah.
There was a bigger impact perhaps about, I guess it was 2011, that there was an experience study.
Right.
And that's when there was probably some big cost for mortality. And then now that this law's in place, it's not a big change from that table.
What
to this table, so that's why, you know, that's only, that's less than 1% of the liabilities.
Okay.
So it's not a huge impact. I just wanted to point that out, though. And that
was required by state law.
Yeah.
State law that required every plan in the state to do that. More than something we just came up with.
Exactly, exactly. So all the city and fire and police plans across the state are moving to that table as of this year. Okay, so page 5 breaks down that experience a little bit more detail. So for the retirement, we had, the plan had 3 retirements, only one was expected, so that created a loss. The turnover, not a huge loss, but more than expected. A turnover is a interesting gain loss because it depends on who's terminated and who hasn't.
If it's a young one, then it's a cost. If it's somebody who's been here for 8 or 9 years, then it's a gain.
Right, because if they're getting close to being vested and then they drop off, then there's a big liability that just disappears. While if they're new, you're anticipating to give them a lot more of a cost along their career, and then when they go away, not a big loss there. So, okay, so mortality, again, slightly more than expected, and created a gain. The disability, there weren't any disabilities, so that had some savings. And then the miscellaneous and the other, it's a lot of that 1-year lag, and I know we can talk about that in detail.
Yeah.
So that's a lot of that. Again, that $500,000 looks big, but it's less than 1% of the plan's liabilities, and this is just given, you know, that would be paid down over 20 years. So here the salaries, you can see $1.5 million. And that's just the payroll had quite a spike. We brought the information to the plan to say, hey, look, we saw these people, they had an increase, and it was confirmed that that was the case. So it just has a compounding effect on the plan because we're assuming that payroll will increase
at 5% when it goes up 13%. What happened is after 2008, for so many years, we were flat. We got nothing, zero raises, you know. So finally, after the economy got out of its funk and started, you know, everything got back on track again, then the last, when the union went to negotiations last time, they did get some substantial raises because of all the last five or six years of no raises. So that's why this year there was a substantial increase in the salaries, and I wouldn't expect it to be nearly that much next time around. But that is the explanation for the salary increase.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, you can see it's around 14%, while we expected it only to be.
And all those 5 years, we were getting actuarial gains.
Right.
We were getting no raises, and we were assuming we were going to get the raises, so there were actuarial gains for the last 5 years, and now we're kind of catching up.
Gotcha. Okay. And then I separated out the asset performance. Now there was on our actuarial value of assets, it is a loss because even though there was very strong returns, the smoothing is about 5 years, so we're capturing mainly 2015, which was pretty flat. And so even though the market value returned over the assumption, the actuarial smoothing reduced it down to about 7%.
Okay.
So, just to clarify that. And then if you go to page 6, that's all the asset values historically. And that actuarial over market, you can see kind of where it jumps up and above and below the market value. But it stays a lot smoother than the market value. So that's the idea, is that as a pension, this is a 50-year time horizon rather than a 5-year time horizon. So as things jump and leap, the asset values should stay fairly smooth so that the contributions stay level for the city. And then the historical rate of returns down there at the bottom, just for reference. Okay, so the next page, page 7, this check and benefit payments. Now, 2016 did drop, but If you look at the way benefit payments are tracked in the finances, the drop contributions are just considered kind of within the city's assets. There's no movement. But then anytime a person leaves, drop is considered a distribution, which is when there's a large benefit payment. And if no one leaves drop in the calendar plan year, which happened this year, then there's no real distribution, and so the benefit payments don't look very large, and so that's why there's such a drop. But if you look at the plan experience and who's receiving benefits, who's in drop, there's no real drastic change. I just want to bring that to your attention.
Okay.
Does that make sense? It's the complexity of drop.
Okay.
Just that someone's accruing benefits, and then when they distribute, it's not a monthly payment, it's a large lump sum. It could be almost many hundreds of thousands of dollars. So that's when the benefit payments kind of leap and drop, is if people are distributing their drop benefits.
Okay. I have a question on that. I guess I can bring it up now.
Yeah.
But the union is going to be proposing this, that the union will be... the negotiations come April, May, I think that will be their first meeting. And one of the things they're going to propose is allowing the drop participants to leave their money in the plan. And then make or lose whatever the plan makes or loses. That's why there's no... So what the actuarial benefit or negative be to that if we were allowed to let our members leave the money on the drop and then they can take it out whenever they want it?
We really exclude that drop balance from our assets. We consider that to be money that can't be used for asset performance. It's just considered money that's locked up for another participant or a member. And okay. So whenever we're valuing our assets, we take the finances, market value, and then we exclude any drop balance.
Okay.
Because for us, that's like benefits have been paid. It's almost like a 401k account.
Right.
Like that's someone else's money.
Right.
It's not the city's money to be used. Now, asset performance, again, that could save money. If the plan doesn't perform very well, then the drop balance will be less. But it should be neutral because, again, we're taking that balance out, and so if the assets perform well, they're going to perform well in the drop balance, and then that'll be excluded.
We're trying
as well.
To get. We just did a drop change to where you guys float 0 to 3, no less than 0, max of 3. So what you're after is to try to get more than 3% for those people in the drop.
No.
You're trying to go back.
No.
You're talking about for after they leave drop.
Correct.
So they're 5 years or whatever, leave the city.
They leave the city.
And they don't take their money?
They don't take their money. They leave their money in the plan.
Oh, you want us to start housing their money for them?
We did. Start to what?
House their money for them?
Yeah, in a sense. But there are positives and negatives.
Right.
You know, the positives...
It depends on how much that goes.
Yeah, I mean, the positives are, you know, the bigger the plan is, you've got economies of scale. You know, the bigger the plan is, the more you can, and Dave can speak to that. The bigger the plan is, the more economies of scale.
It'll make great points on investment manager fees faster.
You get your fees down, and you can, you know, a lot of these funds have minimums, you know, so sometimes you want to diversify more, but they have a $5 million minimum, and you don't want to take $5 million out of your other asset classes. And if it costs, if it's of no cost to the plan.
I don't know. How could it be of no cost to the plan if we're suddenly managing people's money who we would not have managed before?
What are you doing to manage it? Because
it's
in the same account.
You take your money. You retired. Your drop period expired. And you take it to the mountains.
Yep.
Your money goes with you.
Correct.
We no longer have any responsibility for you. He's saying leave your money here, and so that's addition that we have to continue to track that. I mean, there's no cost is a fallacy if you're going to tell me that it doesn't cost anything.
I mean, but would minimal cost be a more accurate statement? And I agree with you, there's no such thing as a free lunch.
Right.
But if it's a minimal cost, or it's no additional, it's no additional personnel hours.
What the end game is, what are you trying to achieve by someone who no longer works here, leaving their money with us? I mean, we're not a brokerage house. Like, the plan's objective is not to continue to manage that money for those people. So I'm trying to understand what the end game is.
Because what happens is sometimes you have individuals who are not very financially savvy and who don't know how to invest money at all. So rather than force them to take their money and then find some unscrupulous person and say, yeah, I know this, I heard about this, and yeah, if you buy all this, if marijuana stocks are going crazy, and I've got one guy who wants to buy every marijuana stock, you know, and he's not very smart. And I'm afraid, he just got out of the drop, I'm afraid that, you know. So just to give them some stability.
But I mean, I don't want to create a rule because we might have one guy who's a wackadoodle.
I'm not saying because of one guy. I'm just saying if it's a minimal, absolute minimal cost to the plan.
That's correct. And with 10 years of drop contributions being stayed in the plan, suddenly that turns into real money to help the plan. Because of points, because of economies of scale, because of the ability to make a return,
it's so
we're not liable.
Money, it's not going to help your liability or.
I think looking at it operationally, from a practical standpoint, I think the motivation, as you put it, would be to provide additional professional oversight,
right,
of the participants' drop money,
right.
So. That means the benefit they get, in addition to, you know, all this fiduciary stuff, is there's no way you would get your personal assets managed. What are we doing, 50 basis points, something like that here?
For that. Right.
I mean, it's going to double as soon as you take your money
out.
So clearly,
at a minimum.
Yeah, at a minimum. So clearly, it would be a huge benefit for the participants. But to your point, from a practical implementation standpoint, there's no additional cost to manage the investments because they're just in the pool that's happening anyway. So my question would be more from an accounting standpoint, from an actuarial standpoint, you guys are the ones that are, you know, keeping the money pool segregated from an accounting standpoint. So would there be any additional cost to you to continue to track?
No, because we just get that information from the plan, and it's just like, what's your drop balance as of the plan year end?
It's just the line item.
Well, we now have different drop accounts, though, because right now all the drop balance is treated with the current rule. So you expire in drop, they're asking for market return versus the 0 to 3 that we're guaranteed. So then we have to take those people who expire drop, segregate that money further, and apply a different rate of return.
Okay.
Upfront, there's stuff to do, but then it's done, and we're just simply, you know, filling in our line items in the accounts. And it's, I mean, it's, you know, it's like another person goes into the drop, we create an account for that person. I mean, once the front end work is done, it's set up. We don't have to start over every time. You're right. It's another line item to account for, but the money is in the same. We don't have a separate account with separate investments. It's the same investment pool from an operational standpoint here at investments. It's the same amount of money. It's a small amount of additional tracking is what it is. And once that's set up,
it's pretty simple.
It's set up.
All right, I think this is more of a discussion for negotiations, but I'm just bringing it to the board because this probably...
Is there any administrative cost to the plan for that benefit?
I would say it's of minimal.
And is there any
administrative cost?
Is there any early discussion about what the drop beneficiary is going to pay in order to get the benefits of staying in a plan that is significantly cost effective for them?
Right.
Right.
I can't hire these guys.
Right.
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 and pay.
Exactly. They're going to get a lower grade, and they're going to get the high return, and they didn't have to do anything to do it.
I mean, they're paying this. The individual would be paying the exact same fee, right?
Right, but that's a benefit to them. Exactly. That's not something they could get. So they're leveraging the city's position in order to benefit, and that's where I'm stuck a little bit. That I'm giving this benefit away.
Well, you almost nothing.
I have to answer to taxpayers and people. Not just departments. And I agree, this is definitely a discussion for negotiation table, because the board doesn't have any place in this discussion. It's not a board decision.
Not a board decision. I'm just bringing it to the board because this is something that is going to come up in negotiation.
I mean, well, you know, we can have NIHART run it and see you know, what it all looks like. And but that's a good question. You know, how, because you couldn't get that. It's impossible.
It would be a great benefit to the members.
You do look at costs because of, say, for example, a trailing percentage. The city gets 1, 2, 5, however many, to cover costs. Then you do that. I mean, if that's all we have to do for these guys to get a great benefit, I mean, that's not a bad thing.
The other option would be to give them a fixed amount. And if you do that, then you run into where it could have an actuarial cost to the city. If the plan tanks and you're guaranteeing 1% or 3%, and it tanks 15%, then that's why I said let it float, because if it floats, then you take all 100% of the risk. You take all the risk. In good times, you're doing good, and in bad times, you're sucking up too.
Right. Just like they would if they were external.
Right. So that's why I tend to go with the floating, because then it's of no actuarial impact to the plan. But I'm just bringing it before the board because this is something that is going to become up in negotiations, and the negotiations should be done at the negotiating table. Therefore, David,
exciting. Segue. All right.
You guys really have to be the ones, I think, that would have to put a pencil to it. The more assets you get, the more leverage you have on fees, so it might be collectively beneficial under that circumstance.
I'll just say all the values that would be calculated from a administrative standpoint is all the numbers that we would need, so I don't think there would be any extra information that we would have to derive. So all the record keeping that the plan would have is the information we would need. So that's all I'm just saying. Okay, so page 8 is tracking history of benefit or projections of benefit payments. I think this was just a request last year. So we kept it in the board summary, just to show how they increase. But they, again, take in mind that this is not a cost of living increase. This is just the fact that employees will be retiring later on. Firefighters will be retiring later on with higher benefits due to the fact that their pay is expected to increase. And so that's what that's been. Page 9 is the the way that the actual value of assets and the market value of assets kind of dance around each other. As you can see, in 2008, the market really had an impact on the market value, but then the smoothing didn't go down as much, and then as the market value returned, it matched back up to the actual value of assets. So again, just tracking a pension plan is a 50-year time horizon rather than a 5 or 6 year time horizon, so that the plan isn't paying a ton of money all in 1 year and then pays zero money the next, that sort of thing. We want it to be a smooth payment ongoing. Okay, so funded ratio, again, this is just another measurement of the plan, and we're comparing as many years also to the history of the Florida Public Safety Plan, so that's just the fire or police or fire and police. And
what was the main driver in our funded ratio going down?
The salary and the assumption change. So just the increase in the liability didn't match the increase in the assets, essentially. So that's why the funded ratio has gone down slightly. But anywhere around 80%, it's typically 80% is the target. Any more than that, you could say you're overfunding the plan.
Yeah, and for just quick, for perspective, this plan has a funded ratio almost on the high 70s, right?
Yeah.
So, and that's using a rate of return assumption.
So that's 3/4.
You know, pretty on target. Whereas if you had a 8 or 8.5% rate, yeah, your funded ratio would look like, what, mid-90s?
Well, let's see.
By using a more aggressive return assumption, you can make your plan look more funded than...
8.75% is 91% funded.
91, okay. So.
8.75% is 90?
Yeah, that's that GASB 67 disclosure. Yeah,
right.
Different rates.
But of course, the state is on a glide path to reducing that.
This was done here, obviously, as you're aware. This was done in advance.
That Florida's public safety plans, we did not just pick plans with a 7.75%. That's across all the whole state. So there are plans with 8.5%, 8%. So,
yeah.
And so, yeah, that could be, you know. It's not apples to apples. Okay, so speaking of investment return, page 11 is the request to just see what would impact the plan if the assumption were changed down to 7.5 instead of 7.75. And you can see in that far right column, the liability increases a little under $2 million. Contribution would go up by $300,000. And that percent of payroll is 3%. And that funded ratio, again, goes down. But in the long, you know, again, it's just one of those things where if you think about, if you don't think you're going to meet that assumption, it's a loss. So just these losses will be drawn down every year. Or if you are assuming below what you're returning, you're going to be making gains. There's no way to really target the exact amount. So it's just more or less the appetite for losses versus the appetite for gains. And a lot of the plans around Florida have been moving their assumption down, but I just wanted to give you that value, that impact. And you also wanted to know, going to 7.25?
Yeah.
That would be about 36.5% of payroll. So instead of a 29, almost 30 to a 33 to a basically a 36. So it's about 3% of pay contribution increase for every quarter of the percentage point going down. All right, so then page 12 is that Florida retirement.
Does the funded ratio drop the same?
2%?
Yes.
Yeah, it should.
That's one of the negatives about, you know, I'd like to get our assumption rate down, but the problem with that is it just, unfortunately, it makes the plan look less funded, but that's because you're not comparing apples to apples. Like the police plan, they're at 8%. Their assumption rate is 8%. So, you know, theirs looks... It's going to look better funded than ours, even though if we have a lower assumption rate, ours is actually more sound. Okay,
so page 12 is the impact.
I'm sorry. No.
This is the impact of that new required mortality assumption by the state. And it's a $500,000 increase in liability, but that's a contribution. You know, only 50,000, so it's not a huge, huge impact.
Yeah, it wasn't.
Again, because the plan had already changed their updated the table in 2011. Okay. Page 13 is that there was a state bill that required the plans to show a disclosure using a 2% below their assumption. So this is just what we're going to be reporting to the state. It's not very impact, you know, we don't consider it to be any real measurement. Page 14 is the GASB 6768 disclosures. That's a new GASB requirement. And so, again, this GASB likes to see a spread of plus one or minus one of the plan's assumption for return. And as you can see, no surprise that the funded ratio swings. Now, just to let you know that the difference here is that this includes drop. So that might be, the GASB numbers might be a little different because, well, no, it won't. Because we're just basically adding the drop balance back into the liability, so it really won't have an impact. But just that's why the funded ratio is a little different here. It's a little above 80, mainly because we're giving that drop balance back into the total pension liability and fiduciary net position. And then the pension expense, that's just a measurement that's going to be shown in the GASB disclosure, kind of tracking annual costs on an accounting basis. And that's the end of year 2016 was about $1.4 million in expense. Okay, so page 15 is the COLA fund. This was set up last year, effective 1/1/2016. And to give the retirees the cost of living increase. So this year it was set at beginning at $564. It's and that's not everybody. So the table is a measurement of how long have you been retired and how much service did you have at retirement. And based on, we kind of have a center point of that table at 22 years of service and 25 years of retirement, you'll be getting $564 a year. So, and then these retirees, their years from retirement start at January 1st, 2016. So typically people are getting around $70, $80, maybe $120 a month as a cost of living increase. So the based on the increase in the COLA fund, which is down there in the middle of the page, there were some initial assets, and then we take into account the COLA employee contribution and the excess of the state premium revenues, state premium tax revenues. So that's that whole 50% of the excess can go towards the COLA fund. And then the solid investment return gave the increase to the table to 593 as the starting point. So again, you're not going to see a $30 increase from the 564 to 593. It's going to be more of like a $10, $15 increase for participants.
Right.
And so again, this is it's separated out from the plan assets. It's its own fund, and we give them, there's a 20% asset reserve. So we want there to be quite a buffer in case there's just a number of years with poor performance, that table won't shift down. It'll stay
right
where it is. And then we use a 7% discount rate for our assumption, just to load in conservative.
A little more conservative.
Yeah, and these are going to be retired people, so
right,
you know, it's a flat. You know, we want that investment just to last a long time.
Right.
And so we just want it to be funded on the outset, and we don't want to be giving the COLA increases too much until you know we have that money.
Right.
The plan has that money. Okay, so the last 16, just showing the differences in the population. No real surprise there. Again, at the bottom, you can see the average plan compensation increased quite a bit, 6,000 per participant almost. So, but everything else has remained just about the same. And then the last page, just how the plan is set up, to give that disclosure of all the pieces. But so that's all the formal presentation. I know Randy, you asked if there was you can explain the 1 year lag.
Yeah.
Okay. So essentially, the fact that that we have developed in this report a contribution for the 2017 plan year. And so there's a period of waiting for that contribution to come into play. So there's basically a year of experience to where, like for this year, that contribution was determined based on a different level of payroll. And so once we're putting that money, once that money gets put in, then the liabilities have increased. And so just that impact is delayed on the contributions. And then the way we set up the gain loss basis, so every year there's a new gain or loss or an assumption change or a plan change. And so that the cost method for this plan is to take that and impact it, spread it out over 20 years, amortize it over 20 years. And so the way we've set up that base is that we said the first payment won't happen until the next plan year.
Yeah, when I first got on the board, what we used to do is we'd get the actuarial report, and Diane McDonald, we'd get the actuarial report late in like May, June.
Okay.
And then they had to budget that same year for all that money. And they wouldn't know what they were budgeting for because they didn't have the actuarial report done. So I guess it was about 10 years ago we put in the lag, which said that you're doing actually the prior years now, because that way the budget and everybody can it's easier to budget the money with a 1 year lag, because they know exactly how much they're going to have to pay for that year.
Right, and there's always the true up at the end anyway. Like the last several years, we had to.
That was just because there wasn't enough put in.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Because it was based on.
No.
Because we, for us, our fiscal year runs October 1 to September 30. So when we get the actual report at this time of year, it's fine, because we're in the process of budgeting fiscal 18, so we have plenty of time to build in the numbers or whatever. And if that experience lagged, if there was a shortfall, as there has been a couple of times, we have enough time in this fiscal year to, you know, make adjustments.
Okay, well, here's my thing. Doesn't it cost like $480,000?
Well, okay, so it's really a reconciling item that we put in there to just be able to show here are the contributions going in. So the unfunded is comprised of all these bases that we're paying, that the plan's paying down, and in 20 years it'll go to zero. So that unfunded amortization base, you know, is going to look it's like paying down a house. You know your principal now, you know your principal for next year because you can see the payments. So what we've done is we say, well, we expect that unfunded principal to be such and such as of the end of this, as the end of the 2016, and then we take the assets and the liabilities, and the difference between those two is the gain or loss. So that doesn't change, and that's the accurate gain or loss that will be put into the new base for the unfunded. The 1 year lag is essentially how we're tracking to get to that expected amount, because some of the contributions, some of the payments are different than what that like amortization schedule was expecting.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So that's,
and it's the same across all three plans.
So
it works fine for us.
Okay, so if there is not a cost.
There's not a cost, and I hate to say it, that it's always been there.
Okay.
It's just we're now showing it almost
way.
For our benefit to kind of track it on our end.
It wasn't the savings.
We can explain here, we can point to this number, this number comes out of your financial statement. And then the fact that it wasn't the expected needs a balancing item so that you're not taking that difference and sticking it in your gain or loss. That's, we're trying to avoid putting that in the gain or loss by tracking it to the point we expected in those bases, and then go, what happened this year? With the extra, you know, assets and liabilities, and then that's your gain or loss.
Okay.
Yeah.
I just saw the line on there, the 1 year lag and $480,000.
I can explain you the difference. I mean,
it's not an actual cost.
Yeah,
and I'm okay with it. Let's leave it the way it is if it makes everybody happy. But I was just trying to save the city. $480,000.
If only it were that easy.
Can I ask you a couple questions?
Yeah.
Taking the non-actuary layperson's viewpoint here, pardon my oversimplification of it, but I look at the pension liability as two parts, right? You get your normal cost for, you know, years paying for a year's worth of benefits, and then you have the unfunded, which is the, you know, that UAL is that accumulation of debt, if you will, because we didn't make assumptions like in 2008, 2009, right? So we're amortizing that. So tell me if I'm off base here, but going back to page 2, if I'm looking at how much this plan costs to operate, just on an ongoing basis, so I was just taking the net normal cost line under the city contribution requirement, because that nets out member contributions, right?
Yes.
So that's 618. So then if I take that as a percent of payroll, excluding drop, I come up basically with an annual operating cost or normal cost of just a little bit over 9% pay. Is that fair?
Yeah.
So the bulk of the liability and the bulk of the pension dollars, city required contribution, only 9% of that annual contribution, right, is going to pay for the normal operating costs. The other,
well, for the active employees.
Right.
So just that normal cost is for anyone who's currently employed gaining benefits.
Right.
And not in drop.
Right.
So then that other 1.5 million, that's, again, that, yeah, you can say it's operating, but it's also the experience of the retired members and drop members as well as the active employees.
Right. So that's kind of the unfunded portion that gets paid off. So still a majority of the city's contribution is still paying off the previous
the unfunded, not the normal
shortfall experience.
Yeah. If we got rid of all the normal unfunded, it would only cost about 10% of pay.
Yeah. So just looking, okay, how much does this benefit cost? You know,
yeah, I don't know that you could ever
line up
all unfunded liability, because plan experience year to year, you missed your assumption, more people die than expected,
we'll never meet the target.
And right, it's not really the goal to have all that money socked away in a trust for every person that's coming up down the ranks. You know, you do want to have, because to fully fund a plan could be considered, you know, because that pension money is socked away for that, just that. You can't take that money out again. Mm-hmm. So it gives you that flexibility where that money can be put in later if needed. But, you know, so like, let's say 60 years from now, yes, everything should be paid down because it's just a bunch of retired people. Mm-hmm. If the plan froze or, you know, dissolved or something. If the plan froze, then it's just a bunch of retired people receiving that money out of the trust. Then you wouldn't want much debt on the city's books.
Right.
But right now, since it's still an active plan, the contributions are coming in. Again, that's a large percent of payroll because it's a lot of retired people, a lot of young people. So that payroll is not drop people either. So
right, and that money should theoretically have already been
theoretically
put into
yes,
the system.
Yes.
So that's the shortfall. That's what I'm getting at. That's
yeah,
the shortfall of paying that off, trying to get that
yeah,
wiped out. We'll never do it, but
certainly that's the accumulation of prior experiences, also assumption changes, plan provisions. So when the plan started, the trust had a bunch of money. Oh, we want to increase benefits, but we're going to spread that out over 20 years. So mm-hmm, it's just, it's a lot of the history of the plan right there and all that.
Yeah. So again, for the layperson outside this room, you know, what's the normal cost of this benefit? Well, over 9%.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then one more quick question, if I could. Then the what amortization process are you using for that?
So it's 11% of payroll, so it's the 7.75 with the 1.9% increase annually for the actual monthly, the annual payment.
Okay, so we can't look at a schedule to see what's going to drop off.
Oh, yeah, and the regular report.
It's in the report, yeah. Yeah, I didn't see the numbers in there. Oh, okay.
So you can see
where I'll drop off when.
Okay, so like for example, 1 year you'd get 186,000, that's going to drop off, right?
Right.
So there's no, just for, I was just looking for a quick look, see if there was, you know, any big chunks of money that were going to drop off the schedule, so. Okay, thanks.
Sure. And I think, so the couple more things you asked for, so right now you're starting the, I guess, you know, this valid report will determine the percent of payroll contributions starting 2017 into 2018. And you just wanted to know if the payment were paid as a dollar figure lump sum right there at the beginning of the plan year, what would be the savings? And I think about 180,000 or 0.7% of payroll if it were all paid as a dollar amount right at the beginning of the year.
Say that again, 180?
180,000 or 0.7% of pay.
So you're talking about changing the level dollar funding versus?
Well, the funding is still a level percent of payroll, but just the process of getting that money into the trust.
So they're making a one-time payment at the beginning of the fiscal year instead of the monthly?
Right. So your present value, so that then that piece that just went into the trust and gain a little more interest over the year. So
well,
we're
the
considering
employees are still going to pay their portion on the monthly.
Yeah, so that's just the, this is net of the city and state.
City's contribution.
Not the city and the state contribution then, because we don't get the state contribution either until some other time. So it would be just the city's portion only.
Yeah, we've taken that state money out already as part of the contribution.
So the question for the city would be, that plan might save 180,000, but what do I lose by not having that money invested in my investment accounts? What's my net difference?
Yeah, and if you look at what your other plans
are
making, 1 or 2%, or
well, that 180 is really the difference between. You're basically saying, okay, we're going to get the asset performance of 7.75 from October 1st, 2017. And so we don't have to put in that 180. If you don't put in until the end of the plan year, you got to make up that asset performance, which is basically $180,000.
So could that even be more valuable than, like, say, last year we made 10.8%?
Right.
So that made that even that much more valuable than the 180,000.
Right.
Yeah.
Just so it depends on the plan experience.
Right. Yeah, definitely. So just you know, food for thought. It's on our end, we say money in sooner whenever we're calculating costs. It's going to help the plan, so
right,
or help reduce the plan's costs. And then you asked about buyback liability. What are we using?
Yes,
the entry age level percent of payroll.
Entry age,
which is the same as the plan's liability. And so the way it works is someone who comes in fresh, there's no liability because we assume they'll be paying off their normal costs annually. The city will be paying off their normal costs annually. And then by the time they're at retirement, their accrued liability is the entire, that's whole schedule of normal costs being accrued. So someone who's new would have a very little buyback. You saw that. And then someone who's just about retired would almost have to pay their entire present value benefits to gain that service. And it's slightly different because if it's not military service, then it's just going to be given to that benefit, not their eligibility for retirement. So they can't suddenly get 5 years and then say, hey, I only have 15 years of service, now I can retire. Slightly less costly.
Yeah, we need to look at adjusting that somehow, and I think now we give them the option to make it count towards vesting or not count towards vesting. And
okay.
I guess the standard is all previous Ocala time would count towards vesting, and then all other buyback time would not count towards vesting.
Okay.
To simplify it and just make it a little more.
Okay.
Again, that's a negotiation table discussion.
Okay.
Because that's a plan change, benefit enhancement. For the record, I wanted in minutes that the board's duties do not involve plan enhancements, plan amendments, giving member benefits. The duties are to administer the plan as adopted by council.
Okay. But I still do think that the board needs to be brought up to, you know, kept in the loop.
Well, right, once there's something for the board to consider that has been negotiated and council has decided that it wants to do it, then the board can.
Well, even if it's not, then at least give them a heads up as to this is what is going to be looked at, and, you know, whatever they come up with, the board will actually administer.
Right.
But
so I just want to make clear, you know, I don't want, the board has fiduciary responsibility to the plan.
Right.
So I don't want you guys ever getting tangled in sticky-wicky where it looks like you're advocating on behalf of the union, trying to get benefit enhancements or doing something that's outside of your charge. So, and I don't want the union to feel like things have been negotiated on their behalf outside of the bargaining table. So just, here's my disclaimers.
Okay. No, you're right, and I'm not trying to negotiate, but I'm just trying to keep the board up to speed.
And those, none of that has been presented to the city yet, so.
Right.
Again, outside the bargaining table, it's not really hard to say.
Okay, so I guess one of the questions now we have is, what about our assumption rate? Is now the time we want to start moving that down? Is now the time we want to make that move? Do we think we should be at 7.5, or do we think 7.75 is okay?
So, may I?
Yes.
I think this is a great time since all parties are at the table. You've got your investment consultant, your actuary, and you have the plan sponsor represented, as well as the trustees. This decision should be made jointly. So I think a fair question to ask of the sponsor is, is the sponsor comfortable with the contribution experience volatility of the program the way it's, you know, currently run? And obviously investments are being structured as efficiently as possible, so we make the number with the least amount of suspense along the way. Phrasing the question another way, is there any desire on the city's part to reduce the suspense element of the contribution, primarily caused by fluctuations in investments, or is the experience comfortable since this is projected out over a long term?
Presently, I don't have any direction from council to, you know, adjust investment rate of return or the assumed rate of return or, you know, the plan changes that we made, you know, just a year or so ago. You know, we've been comfortable. You know, the state, there's a lot, you know, legislation introduced to move towards DC plans, to lower those rates of return. You know, you'll hear them throw out 6.75 sometimes. So, we are hesitant to make a decision on what the assumed rate of return should be just based on what the stroke of the check is. We want to have the proper assumed rate of return based on the plan mix, the objective of the plan, you know, the makeup of the plan, so that it's proper. And then we'll pay what is required based on a proper rate of return. So we defer taking note of the experience of the investment council to, you know, set. You know, the state is definitely moving towards 7. That's where they're headed. If you look across the state, you know, most plans on the average are still at 7.5. It's pretty standard statewide, but some are dropping. But we don't have a preference one way or the other, just the plan. You know, and the plan has performed well, you know, over the long term. It's not had a struggle to make it, you know, sooner than return to the client.
And obviously you and staff are
aware here of the time horizon conflict, that there is a cost associated with getting higher returns, and that cost is interim volatility. So it's a matter of coming to the right blend. So, okay, so I guess from an actuarial standpoint, do you guys have any issues or any?
Well, we tend to look at what is the investment portfolio and what are the returns now. Like I said before, if you have volatility, it just shows up in the loss, which can be smoothed out. But it's just what's the appetite for years of losses accumulating, like you said, the $13 million. That would, if the assumption were high and you're not returning that, then that number just keeps growing and growing and growing. So you're paying down that volatility over a long period of time. While if that assumption is a little lower and you're meeting that a little closer, then your volatility and your costs may remain lower throughout that, even though you're paying a higher dollar per year. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So just from an investment viewpoint, you know, we think if everybody's comfortable with the likely volatility outcome, you know, we think there's a reasonable probability with all our, you know, various forecasting modeling, forward-looking, backward-looking, that current portfolio has a reasonable probability of hitting the return over the state requires long-term, intermediate-term, and short-term any given year. But again, part of the reason for the discussion here with everybody here is to recognize that in any given fiscal year, we might exceed it, we might fall short of it, and the actuary is smoothing the results to try and take away some of that volatility impact. You know, so from our perspective, we're comfortable. But now, as an advisor to you as a board, as was correctly pointed out earlier, you're charged with implementing the policy, and part of your charge as a fiduciary is to do whatever you can within your power to make sure that it is properly funded for the benefit of the beneficiary. So lowering an investment rate of return is one way to get there, but it has to be, if it is going to happen, it has to be done harmoniously from a budgeting standpoint.
Yeah. Well, if you look at page 6, if you look at the bottom of page 6, the historical rates of return on the market value or actuarial value.
And that's that 5-year smooth?
The actuarial value has this 5-year smoothing.
Yeah.
You know, we're right around 7% over 3 and 5 years, and mm-hmm. of course 10 years, and 10 years has that as soon as 08 falls off. Yeah. 08 falls off in there, that'll kick up a little bit, but it's 7-ish, I would say, and I think we need to head in that direction. We've discussed it at numerous meetings before. The better time to do it is in good times rather than in bad times. And
it's easier during a market rally.
Yeah. So I would recommend that we go to 7.5%, but the only bad thing about it, the negative side of it, is it just makes us look less funded because it'll drop our funded ratio. But if you want a strong plan or a weaker plan, it looks stronger than it actually is.
Right.
I mean, definitely the lower rate of returns will result over time in greater surety in the funding of the asset pool.
Right.
Because you're getting more contribution from a steadier source rather than which will still, over time, contribute about 65% of the cost for a plan that typically has a 7.5% to 8% type of return assumption. So everything would still be consistent, but you'd just be turning up the surety gauge a little bit and doing that.
I think it's prudent on the board's part. I mean, that's a, you know, a sound, prudent decision to make for the health and overall benefit of the change.
All right. With that being said, I'd like to entertain a motion to accept the report with one change to the assumption rate to lower it to 7.5%.
So moved.
Okay.
Second.
Okay. Motion by John Dozier, second by Jim Williams. Is there any opposition to unanimous approval? Wait, we got a first and a second. Any more discussion? Okay. There's no opposition to unanimous approval. Seeing and hearing none, the motion carries. Okay. That COLA adjustment, is that usually, do you know, do they usually, is that just included in the report, or do we have to do that separately, motion separately, or do you?
Oh, like that COLA letter from January?
Yeah, the adjustment in the COLA, or is that?
Just, you know, it would be like a second motion, I would say.
Okay. All right. Then I would like to entertain a motion to accept the recommended changes to the COLA fund as recommended by the actuary.
I'll make that motion.
Motion by Jim Williams.
A second.
Second by Justin. Discussion. And if you have any questions on the COLA, he can explain it better. What they do is they keep like a 20% reserve in there, like in Miami. He's done it, they had done it for many years in some of these other cities, and like after 2008, they went for like 5 years with no adjustment, no increase at all, because they used those reserves. But now that time, I think 1 year or 2 years ago, they finally got the adjustment upward. So they keep, and they use a 7% assumption, you know, so they keep it very conservative, so you can handle a big hit like 2008. So it seems to has been working extremely well in Miami and a couple of the other cities where it's used.
How does the timing of future increases come in? Meaning, this report's dated January 26th, so it would be, so then there would be, say, January 26th of 18, just to pick easy numbers.
Well, you know, what we try to do is target, then the January 1st payment goes out January 1st.
Right.
So this coming fall, we would prefer to get the updated data and assets, like November time frame, end of November, mm-hmm. and then we can roll out what the asset table, the asset, or the COLA assets would look like, what the COLA table would look like, and then the benefit payments to
start in January.
Right. And so this... just the reason that this was after January 1st, 2017, just getting that data on a timely basis.
Basically, Jim, what we need to do is have Alicia work with the actuary to get the whatever information they need as quickly as possible, and if they can get the information, then we could probably, is it possible that we could do it at our November meeting? Or is that too soon? But it's hard because it's at the end of the fiscal year, September 30th,
right.
And so a lot of these, especially real estate, they don't report for 3 or 4 weeks till after the quarter ends, so it's hard to get the number.
So the timing is,
the numbers are there.
You know, fiscal year ends.
Then we have to wait to get all the numbers.
Right, the reports are compiled.
Right.
Our meeting passes, the reports are done being compiled, the data is put together, and the January 1 payment is made, and then in February we vote on it.
Yeah, I mean, Miami does like a December meeting. They meet specifically for the COLA. So I'm saying if that doesn't sound,
special meeting.
If that doesn't sound possible, this can just be retroactive.
We can, but I just, because it's volunteer, you know, I just like to try to concentrate everything on our quarterly meetings because it's already, you know, I already appreciate their volunteerism as much, so I just hate to keep having people come in for special meetings.
Can we either one have a special meeting? Or one, is it prudent for us to do it in the timeline that we have right now? I mean, is it prudent for us to vote on something that we've already begun paying?
Right.
We haven't begun paying yet.
not the increase. We have 26.
It'll be retro back to January.
So they get a retro check after the
after this meeting.
Okay, that's what I was asking about. That's what I was asking about with the timing. So then looking forward, I mean, I know this is the first year. Looking forward, January 1 will pass. We haven't voted on it. February comes, we vote on it. The beneficiaries will get a retro check in essence.
Correct.
Okay. So we're not, I'd say the only other was, you know, would we, for a November meeting, have something within a percentage? You know, say, okay, this is our estimated number of vote on it.
And I don't know.
I don't know what would be.
Or we could also say, you know, just make a motion to go with the projected recommendation of the actuary.
Right. Well, I mean, as long as we're acting prudently, I remember, you know, looking at the plan on my own, I was, you know, kind of, you know, we're voting on, in essence, we don't know how much it is, we're making a change. If we're not, we're not. You know, there's a change happens and then we vote later. And I didn't know if that was
right.
The right thing to do.
Well, but we'll have more discussion with this between Alicia and the actuary and see what we can come up with.
Right. I mean, it's not something that we can solve immediately, but just to look at how things are being done.
Right. You know.
You know, in essence, it's, you know, we agree to pay for this. Let me know next meeting how much it was.
Right.
You know, it's kind of the timeline we have right now.
Yeah. I mean, there's the option too of changing it from January to March or something like that too. You know, it comes around every March, but I don't know. We'll,
I mean, in the short term, meaning the first couple of years, I don't want to come in December if that's what it takes.
Right.
You know, I mean, I know I'm one person on the board, you know, or if in the November meeting, we can have an estimated number and we accept it within a reasonable bullseye.
Yeah. That's,
you know,
yeah,
if that's, you know, reasonable.
I mean, the impact is not huge. You can see
right.
That COLA payment's already coming in month to month.
Right.
And then the increase in this example for the person with 25 years of service is only $5 a month.
Right.
So the retro payment, $15.
And it's insignificant.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, as long as we're, I really didn't look at the actual helmet. Yeah. Just, you know, are we doing it the right way? Are we doing the right thing the right way?
Right.
Was my question.
Okay, there's a motion on, we'll continue this yeah. and come up with a plan. Motion on the floor, a second. Discussion has been done. Is there any opposition to unanimous approval? Seeing, hearing, none, the motion carries. Okay, and then we have to approve a letter. Is that you?
Yeah, so I was just kind of killing two birds with one stone with that last exercise discussion.
Yeah.
So I will forward to your attention the confirmation letter that goes to the state actuary, basically saying on advice of our consultants, we think the plan will meet the ROR objectives. And I will also put in there that at this meeting, the assumption was lowered to 7.5 from 7.75. And okay. Then you can send that on to the state and we're done.
Okay. Do we need a motion? Do they usually do a motion for that, Dave, or is that
yes. State? Yeah.
Okay. Motion to send the letter to the state. The state requires about 5 years ago, or no, it's just more than once it's been there for
yeah.
a long time. The state requires us to say that, send them a letter saying that we believe that our assumption rate, that we will make that money in the short term, long term,
intermediate and unreasonably short term.
Yeah. Anyways, a motion to go ahead and send that letter to the state saying that we're in we in conjunction with our actuarial and investment consultants that we agree that our assumption rate is a reasonable assumption rate that we can meet.
I'll make that motion.
Okay, motion by Jim.
Oh, second.
Second by John.
Okay.
There's no opposition to unanimous approval, then the motion carries. Okay. All right. I guess we move on now to quarterly reports.
Okay. Since Neihardt was really the... I'm going to save you guys all the time today for the most important event today. I can go through this pretty quickly since this is the first quarter. I just had basically three items on my agenda today. There's one more. And I wanted to take you through our rebranding, go through the report, and then I actually have an action recommendation that pertains to one of the investments. It's a good thing, not a bad, you know, call to replace somebody. So first off, if you take a look at the back of the book, conveniently, our new name and company logo are one and the same. But you'll notice there's a little line coming off the end. It almost looks like a misprint. So flip to the front of the book, and you'll notice that line extends, and it's actually an extension of Ocala Firefighters Retirement Plan, you the client. So our whole purpose in coming up with this name was to communicate as best as we could come up with that we are an extension of the client. The client comes first. So everything I'm doing, our resources, all the way down to our independently structured business model is your resource source, and clients come first. So the new name of the Bogdan Group, which it's going to take me after a decade to get used to this, I will slip the tongue, is AMCO Consulting, and that's basically the genesis behind the name change. Took two marketing firms to do it. First one got fired, second one got paid some pretty good money to come up with it, but we thought it, we're really excited about it. We thought it was a good all-in-one. Okay, so going to, for any agreements or contracts, so far all the pension attorneys are coming back agreeing with us because we had it reviewed. The actual ownership from an ADV filing standpoint doesn't change. So my partner, Mike Welker, who is leading the charge, as I've already told you guys, he bought out Joe's shares, so that makes me a minority owner now, but something to file, we're still the same. And I'm very excited to announce that we also set up an equity sharing program that is kind of a non-balance sheet, non-official filing ownership. So it's like a profit sharing program. And we announced six new equity partners with this program at our January consultants retreat. So I'm excited. I have more partners to work with now. And we're trying to, lock everybody in. We've got some great people. And you got to provide, the right incentives, not just salaries, to hopefully, keep the good people on board.
Skin in the game. They got skin in the game.
If we make money, they benefit. So, and obviously, if we do well, you guys are already doing well. So, all right, so going to the book is, while you're flipping to page two, the December quarter covers the pre-election equity bear market, the post-election equity bull market, and most significantly, the huge sell-off in the bond market. And then the third item, which was consequential to us, was the fact that as a result of all this activity, the U.S. dollar had a huge surge of strength during the quarter. So those were the big events. So all in, if you look at that top right chart there, international equities were down across the board with emerging markets down a little more than everything else. Most of that negative return is actually due to the negative currency translation because the dollar appreciated, so our money overseas, we lost money right out of the gate. It didn't matter what the equity markets did, just based on the strength of our dollar. In blue at home, flag blue, the S&P 500 was up 3.8%. And as you go down into the smaller cap stocks, they were up the most, up 8.8%. If you go into the green, which we should be printing in red this quarter, the Barclays U.S. aggregate was down 3%. And most of this loss occurred in a two-month period. So there was just not enough coupon to offset the negative impact, you know, as interest rates go up, you got to mark your bond prices down, and it was a, I mean, if you did a statistical bell curve, right, the degree sharpness, the short period of time, and, you know, the basically the degree of the move in interest rates was so extreme, it would definitely fall outside the, you know, the normal statistical curve event there. Obviously, the more sensitive the changes in interest rates, the worse the return was. So even though the Barclays U.S. government has all U.S. government securities, it lost more money than the investment grade bond index, which obviously includes a whole lot of non-government, you know, rated credits. So pretty huge event. I won't drag you through the charts, but I talked about this a little bit before, but it was basically what I think is fair to describe as a tectonic shift in the investment theme in the marketplace. What was arguably driving stock prices previously was the quest for dividends. If stocks paid dividends, they were in the top performing quartile, and stocks that had good, you know, earnings growth were in the bottom quartile as far as, you know, the stock performance if you dissect the S&P 500. So we had a big shift, and the dividend payers were sold off, and the more economically sensitive stocks, you know, popped in price. So those are the areas that have been driving the post-election market. There was also a focus on domestic equities. Obviously, smaller mid-cap stocks got a pretty good bid. And so I think you can say that the marketplace is basically taking a position that the Trumponomics plan is probably going to get passed. And that means instead of us being in maybe the eighth inning of the game previously, now maybe we're at a minimum going to extend economic growth and prosperity for a while here, or at a maximum, you know, maybe we're starting a double header here. We don't know. But either way, the market viewed the program is very constructive. The wild card out there, of course, is what happens with the import-export piece of the equation. We'll have to see how that, you know, trade protection.
We got a little peek about that, I think, over the weekend.
Yeah, there's little trial balloons, I think, coming out. And so that's the wild card. So we'll have to see how that plays out. But, you know, by and large, obviously, with the Republicans control of all three branches of government, and, you know, arguably, you know, I think we talked about this before, a take no prisoners cabinet instead of, you know, Fortune 500 executive companies, executives, you know, they're going to hopefully put together a financially responsible and good growth plan if they can. So we'll see. So this quarter, we're kind of a, you know, sit, you know, we made the big adjustment, so now let's sit tight and see what gets passed. So going to page 18, the good news is this program fared very well during a pretty volatile quarter. And if you follow with me on the top line, we were up 1.76%. So just if you do the annualized equivalent of that, that's what, a little under 8% or so annualized return. I don't want to do that, but just for return perspective, so you actually did earn 1.75% on the quarter. Year over year, for periods ended December, we're earning 9.65%. 5 year, as we discussed previously, includes you know, that that one poor year where the market sold off right at plan year end. So we're annualizing at 5.45, 5 year at 9.22. You can see the total fund policy. Happily, we are actually back ahead and longer term back even to policy. So we had a few things work out, which I'll go through. And then our tertiary comparison here, obviously, is the peer groups. So, and that's just a quarter, so the K count for much, but you know, we ended up in the top 11th percentile with that return. But the 1 year, we're top 6, 3 year, we're top 14th, and 5 year, we're top 23rd percentile when we compare these returns to other public fund systems across the country. So that was very nice to see. Continuing down, just quickly hitting some high points. The Dalton All-Cap Value strategy has had a nice little run here for the last two quarters. They got 8.23 in the quarter, and their year-over-year number now is a little over 4% ahead of the benchmark at 22.78. The Large Cap Growth Index, again, we were served very well
by
indexing the growth space in particular. This has been an excruciatingly difficult area for active managers to add value. So that decision came back and paid us well, even though we didn't pay a whole lot for the index fund. But we basically got what growth stocks gave at 6.5%. At 1%. And then bumping back up, we of course have the value split between active and passive. So the passive strategy was up in line with that Russell 1000 value index. Small cap stocks, we've got a good slug there. So clearly we benefited from that. No manager risk there. We own the index. Jumping down into page 19. The international manager struggled. You can see the benchmark there, the MSCI All Country World ex-US actually finished in the top 6th percentile. So this is a pretty problematic period for active managers with all the churning and volatility going on. The Euro-Pacific Fund, this is probably one of the worst periods that they've, you know, we've had. Going over that 15 plus year experience with that fund, but fast track to, you know, this month and that January, you know, they're already, you know, closing that outperformance gap. So, you know, again, we're strong advocates of maintaining that that manager strategy. Shifting into fixed income, the inflation protection securities were down less than the aggregate market, right? Because TIPS are a little more defensive way to play bonds, because they will adjust, the value of the bonds will adjust with CPI, and they trade with inflation expectations, so they lost less than the index. Integrity had anticipated correctly and was less interest rate sensitive than the benchmark, so they outperformed by 1.16%. So when we really want a manager to perform well is when the assets are selling off, and you know, they saved us a whole percent. So in this case, active management finally paid off. So the 1 year, you know, they're ahead by just under a percent so far. Global bond strategies work very well. PIMCO Diversified Income Fund was down about a percent. That benchmark was down 1.7. So the year over year for periods in December, that fund has given us a whopping 10.65% versus the benchmark at 7.3. Great peer group rankings for that fund. The other out of the statistical norm event was the Templeton Global Bond Fund. They were up 8.32%.
Crazy. The
benchmark was down 8.5%. That is almost a 17% for a bond fund, a 17% rate of return differential. That's way out on the curve, okay? Yeah. Hold that thought. That's what my recommendation is. I'm going to come back to that one. All right, so next page.
That's the one we were going to get rid
of. So how did they do it?
We need to have a conversation about that. American Core Realty Fund and UBS, you know, are two very low leverage conservative managers, you know, coming in 1.5%. I do know that the one-year returns are starting to, you know, slip down a little bit, but that's consistent with, you know, our previous conversations. We're expecting, you know, the real estate returns to kind of start leveling out a little bit. And their peer group ranking is not particularly attractive, again, because they are very low leverage managers, and it's the more aggressive managers in a you know, really popping real estate environment that are borrowing money to make returns that are going to end up in the top peer group. So these funds, the peer group ranking is going to rotate whenever the cycle turns and, you know, inevitably rolls over.
The Intercontinental uses more leverage, don't they?
Yeah. Now, UBS is going to roll up to the top quartile, mm-hmm. and Intercontinental Real Estate, as a leverage manager, and I'm sorry, I grouped them together, as the leveraged, more aggressive manager, was up 5.7%, right, and with great peer group rankings for the short period that we've had them. You know, so these two managers are going to switch positions from a, you know, relative standing point. But again, we've got great diversification here, because if you go to you know, if you go to Manhattan and chances and go by some, you know, marquee building that's, you know, some famous building of note, chances are it's in the UBS real estate fund, right? It's the mega property deals across the country, and Intercontinental is in more the peripheral metropolitan marketplace with you know, smaller property size. So you got diversification in style, use of leverage, and in property type. So, you know, we've got the map covers hopefully. All right, so let's go back to the Templeton Global Bond. So how did this happen? The bottom line was, as you all are aware from previous conversations, this is a very, this fund was put in place because we wanted a fund that had little to no sensitivity to changes in interest rates if one day interest rates actually went up. So it has a pretty much a neutral zero duration, and it was not impacted by the bump in interest rates. So how do they get the money? Well, they're obviously collecting coupon from the various governments of sovereign debt that they own, but the main play was from their active currency positioning. So remember, the dollar was very, very strong, particularly against the euro, and looking at the portfolio weightings, about 60% of the currency exposure was being short the euro. And you think about the huge run that they've had this strategy in place for a long time. This is what, two and a half, three years ago, euro was at $1.55, right, if I'm remembering right. And it's come all the way from $1.55 all the way down during this quarter, down to $1.04. And they have been short that, and along with some other currency plays that they have in there, that every single one just hammered for this period. So
they're pretty smart right now, aren't they? They're feeling pretty smart right now.
I mean, to your point, and especially as a former portfolio manager who had the opportunity to sit in this guy's seat, I mean, Hassenstoff, a portfolio manager, I think his sleepless nights have just begun, because you got
to
be sitting there.
Turn around. Yeah.
All right, what's my act two? Yeah, and should I be taking these off? Because one thing you learn the hard way in doing this in this business for over 30 years, and I know you can relate 100%. When you're greedy, you risk retracing all of your profits. Yeah. So he's in a very uncomfortable position. So. Now, as a firm, ANCO Consulting, right, is we're 100% behind the strategy, the manager. They've done a great job. But as your consultant, we're here to make money for this plan. We don't care about rewarding managers that have performed well. In my opinion, this is an opportunity to actually take a profit, close the strategy out. My recommendation is to liquidate all shares, close the strategy out, and take advantage of what was a very, very aberrational marketplace and very, very aberrational returns coming together. It was the perfect storm for a great event coming together to give us a huge gain. Because if you think of it, think about it, the purpose of the global bond strategies are to diversify, again, away against the risk of the U.S. bond market, number one, and number two, just to get additional, diversification and have some different strategies in there. So the strategy did exactly what we had hoped it would do. Now, let's think back to last year, okay? We were concerned because the performance volatility of this fund was much higher than we had anticipated, because we didn't know currency volatility was going to be this high. And this fund was floating around the 90th percentile.
Yeah, I just remember when I said they were looking at getting rid of them.
Yeah, and I know that Morningstar even dropped their ratings, and the fund has seen quite a bit of money flow out of it, okay? But I like to think that we had a better grasp of what the manager was doing and what the construct, the operating policies of the strategy were. So for us, it fit perfectly in this diversification strategy, and it happened. So my recommendation is that we take our profits, we close this out. We can always go back in at a later date if we want, but we take the profits and close this out. So now where does the money go? So I think we also have an opportunity to, if we allocate those dollars into the Treasury Inflation Protection Portfolio, which we've already established, strategically, we're trying to be cycle aware here in the investments, right? So strategically, we've been way underweight the target in the TIPS, and that's been the right thing to do. But at some point, we want to get that TIPS allocation up to the 5% of total assets target. And so this seems like this would be an opportune moment to start reestablishing that position, and we would be buying it at a discount, right? We're selling one fund that was up over 8%. We're buying into an index fund that was down, a little over 2%. And that's a lot for a bond fund. So we're buying at a really nice discount, and we're selling at a really nice profit. And then looking at the asset itself, it fulfills the same purpose, right? Because that particular type of treasury portfolio is a form of a real asset, because as CPI goes up, which it did last week, the value of the bonds in there get adjusted up. So usually when inflation goes up, right, usually you expect interest rates are going to go up, so your bonds are going to get hit worse. But as we already saw, the TIPS portfolio went down less because it is a little bit less sensitive to changes in interest rates. So it's a more innocuous way to start filling that in. If interest rates go up, yeah, we won't see the best returns out of that portfolio. But we're slowly reestablishing what we want as our insurance policy in there, so then when, hopefully we won't see another 2008 or 2009, but when the economy and the cycle does roll over, which it will, we will have a meaningful slug of U.S. Treasuries in there, which will be up 13, 14, 15, 16%, which is exactly what we get out of it during the 2008. It was a great investment to have during that market crisis, because we got huge positive returns out of it. So it's not a short-term knee-jerk market timing recommendation by any stretch of the imagination, but the opportunity, I think, is presenting itself to be proactive in here, make a change, let's lock in some profits, and with an intermediate term viewpoint in mind, start bringing our TIPS allocation back up to what our long-term policy is. So in short, I'd recommend that we close out, sell all shares of the Templeton Global Bond Fund, and allocate those dollars into the existing TIPS. So in dollar terms, just flipping up to page 16, Tumbling Global Bond Fund is just under $1,915,000. Actually, market value $12,931,991. I think we fast forward to today's value, we're probably right around $1 million. Okay. We had a little more appreciation out of that. And that should be roughly, flipping back up to page 11. The Templeton Global Bond Fund is at 2% of total assets. And our TIPS portfolio is at 1.4%. So that would bring us a little, obviously bring us still below, but closer to the longer term target. So in fairness, I think we can, you know, not expect to make a whole lot of money going forward out of the TIPS portfolio. It's more of an asset allocation tool to start preparing, you know, the portfolio for, you know, whenever the cycle rolls over. But frankly, I don't think we're going to see a whole lot of positive return coming out of the investment grade bond portfolio either if capital IF interest rates continue to go up.
With a zero duration, they're not, without the currency, the returns are not going to be much anyway.
Oh, right. If they choose to close out and you know, go flat on currency bets, then their return, I think the fair estimate, you'd probably agree, is whatever the current yield on the coupons in the portfolio is. So that's going to be, with an environment with rates unchanged, that might be a 3.5% return. But obviously, if interest rates go up, if they keep the zero duration, it shouldn't be affected. So we should get an annualized 3.5% out of it. So arguably, in an unchanged environment, you know, we could earn more money in a Templeton fund, but it depends what he does. And again, sitting in the consultant's chair now, looking at probability outcomes, and you know, we want to hire managers with a repeatable process. Never say never, but I don't think we're going to be looking at 16% outperformance anytime soon. So, my propensity looking at playing the odds would be to, close them out. But it will punish the good manager.
The good deed goes unpunished.
Let me stop there.
I personally don't have a problem with it because they were down in the 90th percentile 2 or 3 quarters ago, and we were looking to get rid of them then, you know. So now, you know, that's the whole thing with the market is, you know, buy low, sell high, and that's what we would be doing. And it's very volatile. That fund is extremely volatile.
Yeah.
I mean, it was good to see this return. It's good when it's positive. But now on page 12, would that be taking from the -1.2 the global fixed income and putting it towards the domestic fixed income, right? So
yes,
the 1.2 would go down a little bit, and the domestic fixed income would go up.
Yeah, so that makes our domestic fixed income, which is supposed to be the anchor of the portfolio, gets us a little more comfortably closer,
right.
We're reducing that underweight. I mean, looking at, well, we're on page 12, I mean, we've been dead on with the asset over and under allocations. As we strategically talk about it every meeting, I mean, we're overweight domestic equity, that really helped. Way underweight investment grade fixed income, so we missed the majority of the sell-off, and we've been way overweight real estate, which has just been a phenomenal steady returner in here. So you know, from looking at that page, it would behoove us to get things a little bit closer in line, but I would, longer term, I would, intermediate term, I would still want to keep the same overweights and underweights. Just make that adjustment.
All right.
I'll make that motion.
One second. Okay. Motion by Justin, second by Jim Williams. Any more discussion? No discussion? Okay. Call to a vote. If there's any opposition to unanimous approval, seeing, hearing none, the motion carries.
Okay. We'll go ahead and draft the, and actually before I leave Ocala, I'd like to get that in your box, okay. Inbox, along with the actuarial letter. And then send them, we'll just get that sent forward to the custodian and they'll take care of it. Okay, so let me just leave you with cash flow on page 16. So we'll cover this for the record. If you follow with me on the bottom line there, the fund opened the quarter with $51,316,252. At the previous meeting, we had a little rebalancing direction, right? We got that taken care of there. The contributions totaled $731,271. Distributions for benefit payments were $620,000. Investment management fees is invoiced and paid by the custodian, so those are largely just the real estate manager fees, were $29,632. Other administrative expenses for plan operations were $5,879. We break our investment earnings into income, where we earned $408,057. Our appreciation was $496,223. So a little under $1 million net of fees for the quarter goes into the bucket and gives us an ending value of $52,296,282. Any questions on cash flow? All right, that's all I had.
A quick question for you. Goldman, several days ago, maybe the middle part of last week, made a call that this is, from their perspective, given today, they're thinking that active management is going to add more value than passive management.
Yes, and we were looking at, not that we're as smart as Goldman people, but we were...
Nobody is.
We were looking at the same...
All you got to do is ask them.
Yeah, we were looking at this as a this whole event, this thematic shift that's going on in the marketplace, as a potential market changer for this whole active passive cycle. Now, I'm not recommending here yet that we add any additional active managers. However, if we think about what was the driver previously, right, this whole cycle has been driven by the quest for dividend. And you're, whatever the discipline, you're really hiring an active manager, as you're well aware, to find companies that are going to grow earnings faster than people think. And as I said earlier, the marketplace awarded dividend payers and fast earnings growers, especially the growth companies. This is why the growth managers had such a hard time. Those stocks were just floundering in the bottom quartile of performance. So if we are entering an environment where fundamentals matter, then investment managers like Dalton successfully was positioned, and even as a value manager, they were, particularly in the financials that they had, they were positioned appropriately in companies that are doing better and should continue to do better. So those stocks were rewarded. And I think the evidence that helps is if you look at the REIT equities, again, as you guys are aware, REIT stocks were down 2.5% on the quarter. Those are the biggest dividend payers out there that you can buy. And that was in the face of, what did you say, the S&P 500 was up 8% or so, right? Whatever the number was. And that was a negative result for the dividend payers. So if we've moved off this irrational investment of this quest for dividend and move back to fundamentals, then I think that's the basis for their argument. And, you know, we were hoping that, you know, for those reasons also, that it might result in a reversal of the active-passive cycle. So the operating environment, if we continue on this trajectory, the operating environment should be more conducive for active management to once again, hopefully, bring more value to the table. So, you know, we'd be totally in that camp, but, you know, we can just hope. The answer is consistent.
Here's what y'all thoughts were.
Yeah.
And I've read the same thing. And I wanted to bring that up at the meeting too. You know, indexing has done us extremely well. Extremely well in these most recent times. But at the same time, if going forward active does significantly better than active, we need to, you know, own our stuff, you know, and you know, we are very passively invested, and so it's been good for us. But in times where active outperforms, we're just going to have to, you know, realize that that's the decision that we all made.
Yeah, we're getting. I mean, and if you think about it, I mean, what the terminology is, we're getting the beta, right? So we're buying the, for simplicity's sake, we're buying the S&P 500 index fund, and we're paying peanuts to get the market beta. So we get what the market does. So if we're going to pay another 0.5% or more for active managers, if you think about it, we're paying whatever it is, 7 basis points to participate in the market. So now we're going to pay another 0.5% to get that little bit of extra above and beyond the market. That makes active performance, active managers' fees, you know, kind of expensive in proportion to the benefit you're getting. In the old days, people used to think you had to put your money with an active manager to get in the market, but you don't. You're in the market at very low cost. So paying a lot of money for that incremental hope of that incremental outperformance. So, but I think we should leave the, you know, kind of hung myself out a little bit with your active value manager, and, you know, unfortunately that's coming through. So I would hope that the operating environment going forward will continue to be favorable for the one domestic active manager that you have. And I think looking at probabilities, the international equity area, you have a much higher chance of finding a manager that can outperform in that arena. So, and the one you have in place is has a pretty outstanding, I mean, they're not lights out, but they've got a really outstanding long track record of success at a very low fee. So, you know, I think we're properly positioned with regard to the active passive for now anyway. Yeah, good point.
So if we did go active, where would you recommend going active?
It would be, I think, building up, I think the most important place for us to make sure that we have exposure and we're not missing anything is in the small and mid cap. And so I think that should be indexed, because we just don't want to miss that part of the equity market return because the manager missed it. So I think it would be to potentially add and go back into the growth manager space, which, again, that space had the lowest probability over time.
When passive is in the 9th percentile, I just don't know that we can pick the 8th, you know, the top 8.
Right. You know, we should, I mean, my job is to be careful, right, and not look at the point-to-point numbers. Right. Look at what's going on in between that gets you the point-to-point average, right? And there is a cycle. So
If you were going having a discussion, which is the important thing.
Yeah, we may be doing it at the bottom of the cycle, and it may go up, but I'm not recommending that here. Good discussion.
Anybody else have any questions on the report? Okay. Good, Dave. I like it. It's looking good. Hopefully we can keep it up and the markets keep up. And yeah.
Yep. Thank you.
Okay. The minutes. Everybody got a copy of the minutes, electronic copy. Here's a printed copy. I would like to entertain a motion to approve the minutes.
Make a motion.
Okay.
One second.
Okay, motion by Justin, second by Jim Williams. If there's no opposition to unanimous approval. Seeing, hearing none, motion carries. All right. Approval of accounts payable. Everybody, saw the accounts payable. I would like to entertain a motion to approve the accounts payable as presented.
I'll make that motion.
A motion by Jim Williams.
Second.
Second by Justin Hardy. If there's no opposition to unanimous approval. Seeing and hearing none, the motion carries. Other matters to come before the board. There's a couple of things. There's one thing that's come up. Securities litigation policy. Our attorney sent us this thing about securities litigation. Maybe one of y'all can enlighten me on this. If you have... If we're indexed as heavily as we are, and say Sears Roebuck or Ford Motor Company or something is has a class action suit, how does that work? Whereas if you're, what's the difference whether you're actively managed or passively managed? Are you in the class action if you're actively managed and you actually own that stock? But if you're in the index, then you are you actually a participant in that class action?
Yeah, and that's a great question. Is I understand it. Any index fund that's going to be the fund company, and to the extent that they participate or not, or beneficiaries, I should say. They're not going to actively participate. So the extent that they're beneficiaries of any settlement, that would just flow into the fund and come back to the shareholders.
But even though fund. Aren't passive funds mostly derivatives?
And that's the other, depending upon how the fund is constructed.
Yeah.
So to your point, you have to physically own shares to be a participant in any way. So
this is more of it's more of a legal question for legal than it is for.
So I mean, your point is totally well taken because it puts us that much further away from the likelihood of participating in any. Class action suit. The way we're structured right now, you know, it could come as a result of a company owned by Dalton Grenier, right, or a value manager. It could come as a result of, and that would be a direct holding,
yeah,
right?
Now, how often does it happen in fixed income? I mean,
yeah, and then that would be the other place. So the classic is the WorldCom bonds, right? So if the bond manager happened to be in WorldCom bonds, and you know, we were physically owning that security, so we would have been a participant in that ultimate, you know, settlement of that whole thing. Those are the really the only two
that we,
because your point is well taken, the index funds aren't necessarily long securities.
Right.
So I believe, you know, for this fund, those would be the only two. I mean, our exposure would be minimal.
Right.
And he's asking you to implement a policy?
There are companies out there, there are lawyers out there, and they scan and they do all this, they do all the legal work and they do the fighting and they get the settlements and they find the bigger, you know, the bigger holders of the assets, and then they go and they do a class action.
Yeah.
And then I don't know how much of it they keep, but.
Does this plan, I think this plan currently employs a securities monitoring firm, right?
We don't.
So, I mean, this is the way I'm sorry, I haven't seen this until today, but the way I look at, the way I see this policy, okay, it makes sense to implement a policy, you have it in place, but it's established our exposures here are probably going to be pretty minimal. But by implementing this policy, now we're essentially forcing the need, because we're stating essentially that we're going to be required to retain a securities litigation, securities monitoring firm.
Who drafted this for us?
This is from our attorney.
It was his, just, he just came up with it?
Yes.
And asked him?
We didn't ask him to, he just came up with it.
Yeah, because I was also diving in here to see what.
That's interesting. Did we pay him to come up with something for us that we didn't ask him to
do? We didn't pay him.
Okay. Well, we didn't.
Because he's going to take 10%.
Yeah.
He's going to take 10%.
He's going to take 10%. He's going to send the bill.
Yeah. Yeah,
so make sure
there's.
Don't get his money's worth.
No, you know, I'm not an attorney, okay? So I'm not going to speak anything contrary. I just want to make an observation. Okay. The custodian is typically charged with monitoring, and if you were due some sort of payment, that's the custodian's job.
Right.
Now, I would want to make sure that my engagement provisions with my custodian, you know, line item that requirement out. Now, he's putting it in on page 5. Items 4 and 5, he's putting in a policy that the custodian collects the data. Which essentially sets it up for transmittal to the securities litigation company. And then, here's why I think it's 6.
So the attorney that we hire to represent the pension plan has sent us this with no recommendation one way or the other, or no explanation other than a bunch of laymen can sit around and read this and make a decision without knowing the cause and effect of making that decision.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure we could get him on the phone, and he would walk us through it and give us, you know, tell us why it's important that we have it, or explain, you know. But he, as you can tell, he doesn't usually come to our meetings. We're the only city plan that doesn't have our attorney, you know, attend every meeting, because I think 90% of the time we don't need, but if there's, you know, we could call him, we can table this till the next meeting and have him on a conference.
I would like more information.
Okay.
I mean, it looks like all this is our custodian's already doing this. The custodian's going to do all the work. Final to this firm's going to take some off the top and we're going to get the difference.
Yeah.
Whereas our custodian does the work now, if there's an issue, we get to keep 100%, we don't have to cut this guy in. I mean, we're not going to not be notified if there's a problem with a position that we hold. We're going to be notified.
Yeah, at the moment, depending upon the custodian's, depending upon your agreement to the services with the custodian, yeah, they may or may not provide notification.
Something. I did get something. I did ask our custodian to respond. And I can find it. I'll read their response.
And then, and while you're looking for that, you know, on page 6, it states in the policy that the custodian will file in a timely manner accurate proofs of claim on behalf of the board. And again, that's something that should be in your engagement agreement with your custodian. So I think it would be prudent to review the custodian agreement and make sure you do have those items in there. And then,
and if all of those items are in there, then what is the...
Yeah, and where this gets sticky is for plans that have changed custodians, because
it does say something about,
you have this custodian for a long time, so yeah, they're going to have the records going back whether you own the shares or not. But if you just changed custodians last year, they can only go back a year,
right?
So then, you know, then under that circumstance, you're basically telling the new custodian they need to go back and contact the old custodian and research this so we can do it.
And the old custodian generally doesn't make that a top priority.
I think they're required
to research for you,
right,
now that you're no longer paying them.
Exactly.
But I think they're required by law to do it.
Well, they are.
But yeah, it's not their top priority, you're right, but they have to do it, I believe. Here's a letter. The Class Actions Department is responsible for researching, tracking, and processing securities class action lawsuits. The Class Actions Department processes the following: class action proof of claim filings, class action payments. The Class Actions Department actively searches for class action settlement notices from the following sources: securities, Class Action Services, Wall Street Journal, Plans Administrator websites. Likewise, the Class Actions Unit is included on the mailing list of several Claims Administrator and Plaintiff Attorneys offices in the United States. The Class Actions Unit retains transactional data as old as 20 years for Wells Fargo, Norwest, and other affiliated and acquired banks. Media is in the form of proprietary databases, tracks, SNAC, CD-ROMs, and microfiche. The Class Actions Department will automatically file proof of claims for all qualifying open Wells Fargo trust accounts unless the client requests to be excluded from the Wells Fargo filing. Reports around filings and settlement allocations can be requested on an ad hoc basis. Thank you, Dale Richardson.
So they're doing it. This is a third party one, a cut of the work that they did. That's, oh, I see that. Why would we do that?
And actually even taking it a step further, because this sets up that third party to be able to request from the custodian all their records.
Right.
For whatever litigation they might.
Right. Which means they're doing the data mining. This intermediary party now has access to that data, which they can then use to gain money from other clients who maybe don't have a relationship anymore. I mean, it just,
That's a good way to put it. These guys are doing the data mining that the custodian is tracking everything.
Right.
Yeah, they're supposed to be.
And on that, we do we want to go ahead and get a firm to do the to do the securities litigation? We don't have one right now. There was one presented at the board meeting. A couple, I don't know where it came from, but there are several firms out there that that do this.
And they don't charge anything until there's a lawsuit.
They don't charge anything, and then they take a percentage. You know, but it's like, they do all the legal fighting and all that stuff. I've been to several conferences where they go and they do. So, that, you know, I guess we should, you know, look at getting a firm, but we have such a small, you know, so many, you know, just two active managers. So that's why we haven't gone ahead with it to this point.
But Wells Fargo is, they do the service.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
I feel like we're looking for a solution to a problem that doesn't exist.
Yeah, I mean, just looking at it from a practical, operational standpoint, as long as we know in our engagement agreement that it puts the onus of the responsibility of tracking and filing for anything that we are due here as fiduciaries, that's getting done, then beyond that, you know, we're potential prospects to be a lead litigant for the firm
as a minimal to none. We're so small.
Let me ask a question about our real estate fund. Because they own physical properties.
Yes.
As opposed to common shares or whatever. If in fact there is mismanagement of an individual group of buildings or the entire fund, I'm not so sure that Wells Fargo would be able to pick up as much of that litigation, or would they?
You are correct. This and all the litigation would pertain to publicly registered securities,
right? Mm-hmm. Yes.
So if there was fraud or mismanagement of one of the real estate funds, the onus would be on the investor pool to take it upon themselves to litigate. And that would be a completely separate custodian, and nothing that the custodian shadows that collective fund. They have nothing to do with it other than shadowing the value.
I would assume that would be in there, just their internal workings, you know, that, you know, somebody slips and falls in the lobby, you know, so there's a lawsuit, you know, and there's the settlement, you know, and that's all factored
that's a whole other liability exposure. Yeah.
Okay.
And they would, absolutely. All buildings are insured.
But if there was fraud within the actual company that buys and owns the real estate itself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, from a very high level, to me, that's where we would need to have a firm that would be overlooking that type of investment. Right. Relative to what the custodian does for us,
uh-huh.
Looking at publicly listed securities,
right.
Registered securities.
Yeah, and I don't know even that these firms out there that do it on a contingency basis, I don't even know that they look into the real estate portion. They're more.
Yeah, no. So in that instance, we're really depending upon the number one primary purpose when we go in and do a dive on a product. We got to make sure all of our providers are separate, distinctly separate.
Okay.
Unlike Madoff, who was custodian, he was a custodian for his own investments, right? So, rule A, number one, step number one is make sure all your vendors are completely separate and under contract. And we've got a proper audit being done every year. And then that there's ongoing auditing on a quarterly basis with both internal and external, you know, pricing of the assets. And we're also getting confirmation of, you know, ownership when the whole process, the whole audit process takes place. So there's a number of different parties working together, not that one, I mean, the WorldCom was amazing that it happened in the face of all of those things in place, but so it can happen. But we tried to set up as many safeguards and structure as possible before we even bring in the real estate firm.
Sure.
That we would bring out to you to make sure that those are there. So, and then we're monitoring everything on an ongoing basis. But, you know, we can't do the deep dive. But, so that's how we would be doing it. So if something did happen, it would take a investor in the pool, and it would probably be one of the mega ones that kind of drive any litigation that's required for any action.
Okay. All right, so everybody's just happy with letting Wells Fargo monitor and do.
I think it's an advantage to us that we've had a custodian for so many years. Yeah, we may as well take advantage of that.
We haven't had them. We hired Bank of New York.
Yeah. You just said we have Wells Fargo. How long have we had them?
We've had them since about 2002, somewhere around there. But the city had, that was another one of our battles, the city had Bank of New York, so we just kind of piggy-tailed on them because it was just easier for them. But they were giving us such horrible service, you know, that we put out an RFP years ago, and they didn't even respond to it, or they just they made some moves that where we told them to move the money, and they didn't move the money, and it cost us like $35,000 one quarter, and just another mistake, and another mistake, and then they came in and acted so arrogant, and so we went with the other custodial, and the city threw a fit because they wanted to keep it with Bank of New York because they were used to them and accustomed to it. But we said, we can't. They're not working for us. You know, so we went with Wells Fargo back in the early 2000s. But yeah, and they've been good. In fact, now the city just last year hired Bank of New York and hired Wells Fargo, so now all the accounts are with Wells Fargo anyway.
What traditionally happens is if Wells Fargo gets a notice, and we currently own the security, or have owned the security in the past, they'll send the notice to us. And if you go back and look at the records and determine that we in fact owned it, then...
Yeah, so typically what happens, there'll be a shareholder notice of all owners on record, whatever that particular
period of time,
usually 5 years ago, right? date was, and then that gets mailed to the holder of record, which would be the custodian on behalf of the plan,
and then they forward it.
And then they'll review it, and if we're due, then they will file all the necessary paperwork to make sure that the check gets deposited, you know, for the final accounting. So, I mean, just to make sure we cover the bases, it might just be prudent to either confirm that was the attorney involved in drafting the engagement agreement for the custodian?
Yeah.
So
we had this attorney when we...
A fair question of the attorney. Doing it this way could be that, we would like to confirm that when you drafted the engagement agreement with the custodian, that you covered all of these requirements as the letter put forth there as far as filing and proper filing, monitoring filing, and payment of any securities litigation. He should have that provision in the contract.
Yeah, I mean, and she says that even in this letter, she says, retains, actively searches for class action settlement notices from the following sources, blah, blah, blah. Websites, likewise, is included on the mailing list of several plans administrator and plaintiff attorneys.
Unless we have opted out. I think we're sort of holding
on to opted out.
Language in there.
Okay.
Again, I'm not.
So I'm not the attorney. Do we opt out or not?
Okay.
Right? I'd be surprised if you did.
Yeah, absolutely no reason to.
Yeah, wouldn't be in my best interest, for sure.
And how often does this actually happen? I mean, how often do you see litigation coming across your desk?
It's fairly often.
On a basis.
Yeah, if you were entirely actively managed,
there'd be a lot of it.
There'd be a lot of it, and it usually picks up momentum after a bear market. So there was a ton of activity from, you know, the 2009, but it takes 5 years before it gets worked out and, you know, makes its way out.
That's a service contract they provided in your city, and that's why I'm confused as to the need of a policy and hiring a separate firm.
We're just trying to create a business.
Yeah, but I just want to be careful because the record to show I'm not an attorney. I'm just speaking through the operational practicalities of what's in front of us.
Okay. We obviously need more information.
Yeah.
We can consider.
Yeah. I agree. Yeah. So I'll sit and make sure that we didn't opt out on this, and that Wells Fargo is actually. I mean, they said that that's what they say they're doing. So. Okay. We have, Dave, we discussed and tabled we're going to need this. We have two contracts with the Bogdan Group. We're going to have to change those to the names and all of that.
No, we're still good.
Okay.
Because the discussion and approval was made, obviously contingent upon having the finalized amendment. Okay. That was made at the time when we were Bogdan Consulting.
Right.
And again, the attorneys are not requiring us to redo all our contracts because it's just a corporate registration name change.
Okay.
Only. So our contracts are still fully valid. So.
But we never did agree to it. We didn't agree to anything.
Correct. So until you saw.
We had one. One of the proposals was to, you're currently at $30,000, one of the agreements is to increase to $33,000 annually, billed quarterly in arrears, effective October 1, 2016, and will be guaranteed not to increase for 3 years. Then the second one was to increase to $33,000 annually, billed quarterly in arrears, effective October 1, 2016, and will be guaranteed not to increase for 3 years after that date. On October 1, 2019, the fee will be increased by 3%, and on October 1, 2020, the fee will increase by 3% over the previous year. So one was just a 3-year contract at $33,000, and the second one was an increase to $33,000, and then the last 2 years would be an increase of 3%.
Yeah, so essentially a COLA for 2 years.
COLA for 2 years.
The last 2 years.
Discussion?
What
do we have the minutes from the last meeting? Because didn't we discuss that then?
We did discuss it, and we didn't make a decision.
We were waiting for those.
That's the contract for some
time. Yes.
So then at the 5-year number, do we renegotiate at that point?
Yeah, so essentially what's happening, I mean, the contract is, any of the contracts, we're in perpetuity. Mm-hmm. And of course, you can terminate it at any time I don't think we even have a notice requirement. So what the contract is doing is we are guaranteeing our fee so that I would not be able to come back and ask for to renegotiate our fee at the end of 3 years, or with the second one, I think, at the end
it goes to five.
Five.
Did we get it?
Because the first one is...
The first one is a contract for 3 years with an increase of $3,000 per year.
Okay.
The second one is the exact same.
No. It's the same price for 3 years.
$33,333.
And then the other one's $33,333 plus.
And then...
And then about $35,000.
The second one would be exactly the same.
$36,000?
An increase of $3,000 for 3 years. And then two additional years.
Third year level one?
At a 3%.
Well, fixed at 33, so, and then 1.03 times 33 would get us to the next.
Yeah.
And then the fifth year, whatever that number was, 1.03 to that. And then year five, we talk again.
Yeah. Be about 35,000 at the end of 5 years, approximately. If my calculator is correct, it's an operator error, notwithstanding.
I mean, I don't see the. I mean, this is just me thinking, but I don't see the point in us going over the 3 year mark if we don't have to. If it's the same number, I mean, then we just renegotiate after 3 years. Unless you just want to kick the can out in 5 years for that renegotiation, it's not going to cost us. I mean, I don't. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, is there?
To me, it's not going to be a, because in 3 years, I would assume we're going to get a new bill that's not $33,000. Now, is that going to be 3% more than that, or is it going to be more than that?
The reality is, it's on the marketplace.
You don't know the number.
What you do is you fix your costs.
Yeah.
You cap it over a 5 year period. It becomes a known entity.
Yep. And I think that's fine, because that's not going to be.
And
that
it is an actual fixed cost that you can budget for annually as you administer the plan. It makes sense to me to go five.
I'm okay with that.
Okay. Would you like to make a motion to do three? Okay. Motion to increase the fees by $3,000 for the first 3 years, and then the next 2 years would be a 3% increase from that. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Justin Hardy. There's no discussion. No opposition to unanimous approval. Motion carries.
Okay. Thank you, everybody. And again, on behalf of my colleagues, and especially me personally, it's a privilege to work for this board. And thank you for your consideration.
Okay. There's another thing we've got to do. Did you want to change that, or just leave your name there, or change it to Anto, or whatever? If you want to redo it and send it to me, I can do it, or we can just keep it as that.
Let me just double check with my compliance guy. Right. See what email I have.
I think we're okay.
Because on the contract, it still says Bogdan. That's my concern. One of the state laws said that we need to approve a budget every year, and this is the budget. It's basically, we look at last year's budget and then we keep it the same. If anything changed, then we change it, you know, wherever it needs changing.
What you that is. Expenses. This is the expense and revenue?
Yeah.
I'll bring the budget at the next meeting.
Okay, so this is what?
Expense and revenue.
Expense and revenue. We have to approve this?
Yes.
Okay.
This is last year's expenses that you need to be approved. It starts out with the revenue, shows you how much the funds are in, and contributions and gains and losses, or names this year. The next set are the retirement payments to the retirees. That was about $2.1 million. Goes down and lists all the managers that we actually pay through a check, invoices.
See if I'm not moving.
This is for the entire city?
No, this is for this fund. The actual fire fund.
Okay.
These are the expenses and revenues that we take in for this fund.
Oh, okay, all right. I was looking at the left-hand column, not the right-hand column.
Yes.
Because when I glanced down at it, I said, we're not doing business with a lot of these folks.
Generally, there's two other columns for the police in general.
Yeah. Okay, gotcha.
For simplicity and to put it on the internet, for this plan, I just showed the one.
All right.
You can see there's a net gain. But we do need motions to approve. It's kind of after the fact, but I think legislation wanted to make sure that the boards were reviewing the expenses in detail.
Okay, I would like a motion to approve the expense and revenue.
Who made the motion?
Motion by Jim Williams, second by...
I'll second.
Don Dozier. Mm-hmm. If there's no opposition, to unanimous approval. Seeing and hearing none, the motion carries. And that does it for the agenda. There are some schools coming up if people are interested. There's a Klausner conference, and then in May there's a school in Tallahassee. The one in Tallahassee is put on by the Division of Retirement.
That one's in May?
That one's in May.
Do we have exact dates?
Has DRDO?
No. They haven't gotten the date yet.
Yeah, they're late on putting out dates, so it hasn't. As soon as it comes up, I will...
The state report tonight.
What is the Klausner conference?
I'm sorry?
The issues with the state report, I don't know.
Right. They've changed the way they do our annual state report now from paper to computer, and I guess they're having a lot of issues with that.
Well, everybody knows. May's...
But if anybody wants to go to the Klausner conference that's held in Fort Lauderdale, we'll send you the email.
Where do they
want to go?
Where
do
they?
That is in March 20.
Klausner?
Yeah. 19, 20, 21.
Okay.
19 through the
27th. For whom? What
month? March. March.
March.
Okay.
It's just easy.
Just
okay.
Just
something. 19, 20.
I think you have a clock there. 19th
and
22nd.
Yeah. Okay, we'll get you an email about the Klausner conference. If you want to attend, just go ahead and let Alicia know. All right, does anybody else have schools, actuarial reports done?
I just have some kind of legislation.
Sandy would like to.
There's been some legislation filed, or several pieces of legislation filed related to retirement plans in the Florida legislature. Fire in particular is one. Change that they're looking at. They brought back legislation related to the cancer presumption. So that's, you know, active session hasn't started yet, but the bill's been filed. It's related to assuming a whole list of cancers are just automatically job related. So there's, you know, review of that to make sure that it's prudent, you know, that we don't have cost expenses for things that, you know, are not related to this. It's just been refiled again. There's some legislation filed related to FRS, which we are not a participant in, but basically the legislation says if you become a participant of FRS post January 1, 2017, that you're automatically in the DC plan, you can no longer get in a DB with the state of Florida. So the state's push to a DC is well underway. Which they've been on that track for years. It used to, when you got an FRS, you defaulted to the DB plan, the defined benefit, and you could elect to go into the DC. That default election changed a couple of cycles ago where you defaulted into the DC and you had to opt into the DB. Now they're just taking the BB off the table altogether. If you start working for an FRS organization, if legislation passes, you're automatically BB. I don't know if you guys are aware of what happened with Jacksonville. Huge,
yeah.
Huge shift in the pension world. You guys have not seen that. They adopted a DC for their system. There will be no one else getting into the DB, which for a system that size, it's just, I can't even.
Well,
their matching is very interesting.
They created their own monster.
Yeah. So they're,
that story.
Yeah, there's a lot of that story. But at the end of the day, the union bought off on it. It's, signed, sealed, and delivered. They,
police and fire?
Mm-hmm. Now have a DC point. No, fire. They have a fire point. Police and fire.
Yeah.
So anybody who starts working for Jacksonville or Jeff will be logging their combined city county system.
We'll go into a DC.
We'll go into a DC.
Is it going to be the FRS DC or?
No, it's their own. Yeah, it's their own DC. I'll forward you the arrangements of that, but it was a huge deal. As far as pension plans go, they're a huge player in the state. So, we were shocked that they're union, but of course they've been at us for, gosh.
It's a long journey there.
Yeah, it was a long journey there. Let's see if I can find the parameters.
So where bills look at the same. And when they did that down in Palm Beach, it's like the stations were empty.
It's going to affect your market.
Everybody left.
Yeah. It's very much going to affect your ability to recruit. And
so they just reenacted the
DB plan. Yeah, they did that in the town of Palm Beach, was it, I think?
Yeah, I think it was them.
No. Yeah, I want to say it was last Monday.
Wow.
Now, the matching provisions are, like, insane, too. I mean, their percentages. Okay, here it is. I thought I had it. So, yeah, so it's police and fire. So it'll be a 401k style, which will be a 401a because it's government. Of course, their unfunded liability is $2.85 billion.
Like I said, they created their own monster.
So what their union plan their contract, they gave the police, I think this is how they got it through, they gave police and fire a 20% raise over 3 years, plus a 3% lump sum payout upon ratification. So they bought them into the DC, basically. They also, the way the plan is set up, the city will contribute 25% of pay. The employees contribute a mandatory 10% of pay. So that's a pretty healthy DC contribution. I thought ours was rich at 3 and 8, but at 10 and 25, that's a pretty rich, if you were in the private sector. It would be unheard of in the private sector.
I'm at a loss to see what that fixes.
It fixes future liability. That's all it fixes. Because
like way future.
Yeah, because in the DC, and they didn't force. I didn't see where they forced anybody in. Like I didn't see those provisions of the plan.
Probably trying to cap annual, even if it's 4% pay, they're capping.
Right, they're capping future liability, so they'll burn down that 2.5. So the 3% lump sum was immediate, 20% was over 3 years.
It's like no longer increasing the UAL, this is
right.
Kind of saying
they'll just
the
UAL
will
stay
at $2.8 billion until it's paid down.
They will
take any profit.
Because
you didn't freeze it, right? It's still open.
Not the new entrance.
Right, but they didn't
freeze the
current
benefits. They're just saying
they're going to stop people entering the plan for now, yeah. The drop will have an eligibility of 8.4% annual rate of return and a 3% COLA. Their union deal, which was kind of odd, their union, it's a 10-year deal. which I'm like, gosh, the unions, please, and fire, how'd you sign a 10-year contract? But it's a 10-year contract. They have some kickers or reopeners at year 3, 6, and 9 for specific things, but I mean, like, this is historic. In our state, public sector, it is absolutely historic that, one, there's a 10-year deal. Two, they agreed to a DC period end of sentence going forward. I just can't even, I mean, it's, I can't wait for the agreement in my hands, so I can't because I'm like, oh my gosh. And yeah, they, I mean, their annual payments is what they were definitely trying to get down because, you know, they were projected to get $32 million a year just to keep their plan funded, the current plan.
But isn't that going to skyrocket now that they closed it?
There were some other, you know, it just says, and then there were some other reforms. It doesn't indicate, so that's, I'm looking for the actual reports, so I can see what did you advertise, you know, the accountant and his owner now. I want to read that and see.
Well, they can advertise it over 40 years and
right,
the rate to 9%.
Right. So,
and with current retirement rates increasing in 10 years, the demographics of the union body voting is going to be, the majority of them are going to be defined contribution plan members as opposed to defined benefit members.
Right.
And then they're going to start sliding other contracts across the table, and that may affect a lot from a negotiation standpoint.
Yeah, so it's unprecedented in the state. It's just unprecedented. So, sorry, the whole thing was kind of crazy.
And the fire board?
Fire police, both of them. I was like, what? I mean, yeah, I'm wondering, like, you know, they're going to pay through the nose either way, so I'm just not sure. I mean, this didn't cover what plan changes they may have made to that existing plan to bring that down. But I just want you guys to be aware of that because, you know, it's, like, major news in the public safety pension world. So I'm sure at the conferences they'll be, like, dissecting this beast, like, what the heck did we do here? You know, and then with the state going to D.C. only, it's insane. There's a movement afoot. Of course,
it has been for years.
Yes, and it's been a slow move to kill the DB. Of course, I don't know if you, and Dave, you may have read this. Recently, there's been some articles about, you know, was the 401 the right thing to do?
Right,
I don't know if you've read those articles, hopefully.
Yeah.
So, it's going to be a wild ride, guys.
Yeah, we haven't seen a full payout. Like, we've seen people live to their, you know, end of life on a pension. We've yet to see really that first end of life to a
401k. Right.
A 401k.
Right. And that those articles kind of speak to that. And, you know, we made this shift from pension to 401 style retirement. The data so far is not panning out, but that can support someone to end of life for many reasons. The shift was cost burden based, you know, because the pension plans got too rich, and now you're back to the three-legged stool. It was supposed to be
right.
You know, the pension, your Social Security, and some modicum of alternative savings vehicles that you had. Well, you know, the legislature dickered with the Social Security, raided it. You know, the pension plans got too rich. They weren't able to afford, you know, so the 401A comes in as, you know, this is the savior. You know, same thing, Social Security trying to make itself directed. This will be the savior. So it's very complicated in nature, but those of us that are a little bit younger are going to have to live all that out and see what the heck happens because, you know, there's no DB for any of us. So it's just interesting times and, you know, as you guys, as trustees, you might kind of Google some of those articles and just kind of see what's going on with Jackson and Bell, because, you know, I can see the state starting to hold that up as, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And
but we're so well funded and we're getting a little lower in our assumption rate and we're going to be so strong that
it's not going to be an issue here.
And we're very fortunate in that we live in a state that mandates legally
that they pay
that their, have to yeah, their plan.
Annual contributions be made based on the actuary number.
Right. There's no there's no, right, and other states don't have that. So like if bachelor says you owe 30%, you know, and you only pay 15, that's what you do. Like in Florida, that's not legal, so.
There's some things in Rhode Island that are like 30% funded.
Yeah, every entity in Florida pay, you know, makes a payment because you just have to do it. But it's just an interesting dichotomy of, you know, how things are changing in the pension world. And even though, you know, we're a fire is a good example of how to manage a plan, that doesn't mean the legislature can't chip away at 175 and 185 and, you know, which as they've already begun by changing the mortality tables. There's actually been legislation introduced as well to mandate your rate of return.
Yeah, I was just going to go over that. And what they did is they said you have to look at your 30-year returns and then average those out. And if your assumption rate is below that average 30-year return, but the averages don't start until
2021.
So they purposely
gave you a minute to like ease. Yeah.
No, they didn't give you a minute to ease. 2000 and 2001 were the two worst back-to-back, or 2001 and 2002 were the two worst back-to-back years in the financial markets ever. And they put those at the very beginning. You know, they didn't give you any of the high returns of the late 90s.
Right.
But they took those two horrible years in 2001 and 2002 and had that at the beginning of the 30-year cycle. So,
yeah, because if you ran this one back, I mean, the vast majority of plans, if you look at the 20, at least 20, but it's definitely the 25 and the 30-year, which is what in the Stone Age, on day one, we were supposed to be in the term, right?
Right.
It was a 30-year time horizon. We made the number. I'm sure you guys made the number. Everybody made the number.
But when you take that specific, that specific 20 years,
right.
Right.
You've got all the
two terrible years at the very end.
Yeah.
It's,
they're very cute. And that's what I'm saying. They're the attempts to
are there.
Force the wrong one are there.
But you know, I don't think that's forcing us to a DC. It's forcing us to be more responsible.
With the DB.
With the DB.
This move to default DCFRS though?
Oh, I know.
I mean, granted, it's filed, it hasn't passed, but it made its first to me, so. Yes.
You're right.
Yes.
I think their main goal is, but I think they might even be going against their own goal by forcing these plans to be more conservative, because if they're more conservative, then they are going to be more affordable, and it's going to be harder to get rid of them when you can prove that, look, it's very affordable, it's very good, and you don't have, you get rid of this pension spiking, you get rid of the outrageous assumption rates, and you use the conservative mortality table. Those are all good things, I see, you know, to make the plan stronger. And so they might be defeating their purpose by doing that. So that's my opinion.
Yeah, so it's interesting, because if they do force the plans to change how you come up your return, like what you guys just did, you don't have the authority to do that. It'll be prescribed for you.
Right.
You know, what your return rate and assumed rate of return is going to be. So, but as these move through the legislature, I'll update, you know, the board today on any changes like that. So
okay.
They're going to be aware.
Is that all you have? Anybody else? Okay, it is 11:50, and with no further business for the board, meeting is adjourned.